Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. That was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
As the Manchester United players left the pitch yesterday to a raucous reception from the home supporters, Dave Jones on Sky Sports wondered aloud how long had it been since we'd witnessed such scenes at Old Trafford.
2 weeks.
And it was a really obvious answer as well.
Well, I was going to go further back than that. I was going to go back to the late Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The mid Ole Gunnar Solskjaer era, mid to late, when they had him finishing in second place. Just the season before last? Was that as recently as that? Off the back of stirring counter-attack performances, eerily similar to what we saw yesterday. It feels like United have gone a very expensive, very roundabout route to reproducing a version of Solskjaer ball. But the way things were looking after two games of this season, you'd have to say Solskjaer ball will do for now. Welcome to the Football Pod. Hi, guys.
Owen, how are you?
Hey, how's it going?
So, yeah, it appears Erik ten Hag has completely abandoned all his footballing principles. You know, they beat Arsenal.
His guiding principle is victories, Owen.
Yeah. Remember all that stuff I was telling you about passing it out from the back, David? Yeah, no, just get it launched there, mate. Mm. Marcus, don't worry so much about the high press thing. Just run on the end of these pinpoint passes that Bruno's going to send through to you. I sense like I am sneering it. I just find it hilarious how basic it is, but it's working over the last few weeks and happy
to
days.
To be fair, Owen, David De Gea did start the move for the first goal with a pass to his left back.
Shut me up.
Although they were, you know, there wasn't a lot of let's get all our ducks in a row in the 6 yard box and start playing out from here with goal. There wasn't a lot of that, but you know, you could say part of it is what's being done, mm-hmm. but a bigger part of it is who's doing the thing, right? And I just feel with Erik ten Hag, the perception is important. Like without the results, ten Hag is, you know, a bald fraud. What do we think bringing in a guy from the Eredivisie? These guys, they don't know. It's a different game over there. They never make the step up. You know, that's what happens if they're losing. Whereas if they're winning, it's like, you know, it's happening. You know?
Arch pragmatist Erik ten Hag gets the job done.
But it's not, it's the thing of if you get a, you know, reputation for getting up early, you can stay in bed all day or whatever. I mean, people will assume that Erik ten Hag is building towards something. Whereas with Solskjaer, there wasn't really that. It was, okay, what now? You know, I mean, in fairness, when Solskjaer took over, there was obviously incredible results. And, you know, that's why he got the contract in the end. I mean, he was only supposed to be a stopgap. And then they said, oh, actually, he can really do it. But there wasn't, when things started to go badly, there wasn't that sort of sense of, you know, he's shown that he can do this. He hadn't shown that he could do it. You know what I mean? So whereas ten Hag, I think, is always going to have that, you know, in his favor. And you know, when you get good results, no one's going to be complaining. You know, I mean, you just had Keane really enjoying it. It's funny actually when you see Keane and how much pleasure he was taking in taunting Arsenal, especially after the game,
especially Merce.
That, like, how difficult it must have been for him throughout these years, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, he obviously attacks the players, or he talks about their lack of, you know, basic Manchester United-ness. But he has been... he obviously does. He certainly he enjoys it when they win. So he must have been suffering a lot.
He's a good front runner. You know, he like, you know, when United are going well, he's good at that as well. Yeah. But sometimes he just needs a foil. And Paul Merson was a perfect foil for my thought on Sky Sports yesterday, in that he was, you know, Merson's just, he was just going to go for it. You know, Arsenal were bossing it. I'd have taken Eriksen off. He was getting bossed around the park. It was just, it was perfect. And Merson was
taking Eriksen off.
Yeah, he did say that. Yeah, yeah.
After Eriksen had politely come along and done the interview. Yeah.
I thought Eriksen was pretty funny in that as well.
Yeah, yeah. When he's asked to analyse the Bruno Fernandes pass. Yeah.
Why isn't he using his left foot? Would you say that? Would you say that?
He's extremely deadpan in his comedic delivery is Christian Eriksen.
I was laughing a lot more at him yesterday than I was after the Ireland game.
Well, as Roy Keane alluded to, indeed. Yeah. Mark Critchley was at Old Trafford. He's going to be on the show today. And after that, we'll hear from Kieran Canning about Celtic's 4-0 thrashing of Rangers, the perfect prep for tomorrow night's visit of Real Madrid in the Champions League. Speaking of which, to hear our Champions League coverage during the week, you will, of course, need to be a member of the Second Captains World Service. You can become just that in only a couple of minutes by visiting secondcaptains.com.
Kieran is a little perturbed, really, about, you know, the Celtic Real Madrid. Just Madrid's knack of beating better teams in the Champions League has him worried ahead of the Celtic, but it's looking like a pretty tasty game tomorrow. So yeah, we'll talk about that later. What was happening? Well, you know, the obviously this another brilliant result for Manchester United. Put it in the bin, guys. There's nothing you can do now, guys. That's what Michael Arteta, I'm pretty sure, will have been saying to his players after the game. That's what he says when things go wrong for Arsenal. And you know, you need to, maybe they'll do one of those video analysis. I don't know if you, again, you haven't seen it, but Arsenal have a Dutch coach, Albert Stuivenberg, who sometimes sits down with the players one-on-one and goes through some of the stuff that they've been doing and things they can do, little tips maybe that he can offer them and what they can do, things they can maybe do better.
So sorry, this guy's like a performance coach type or tactical football.
He's the assistant manager maybe.
Okay.
You know, he'll sit down and say, you know, you can do this, you can do that. You're a great player, and our job is so that the whole world can realize that. You know, that's what we're here to do. And I can just imagine him sitting down with Odegaard and saying, listen, the next time you're in this position, the ball being played to you from the side, 8 yards out from goal, kick it into the goal. Just kick it in there. Please, just kick that one in. Because Odegaard was, you know, I thought generally very good in the game. He's got this great ability when to receive passes in an unexpected way, like often letting the ball kind of run through him and sort of turning. And he's really, you know, really helps to unsell the defense, but he missed a huge chance. Okay, it was only 1-0, and Arsenal did go on to equalize from that point. And I think he saw with the Arsenal fans that they thought, we're going to do this now. Because, you know, there's that famous statistic about United never lose when they're winning at halftime.
Yeah. No matter how often I hear it, I always reckon it's still, it must be like 92 or something, but it actually does go back to 1984. It's unbelievable.
It's incredible statistic. And really, Arsenal looked at the moment when they equalised like they were going to go on and win this game. And then just another sucker punch, bang, you're knocked out. And then Arteta decides, okay, I'm gonna change this, makes a triple substitution, and immediately the third goal. So that obviously wasn't great.
Was that a mistake? Do you look back and no, that was exactly the right thing to do. We just conceded a minute afterwards. That was the problem.
Yeah, I mean,
it's quite a snippy Arteta post match.
Well, it was a pretty disappointing, you know, because he, like Klopp, was saying, well, we should have won the game. And you're like, well, you know, should have, could have, would have, should have. And that was when that was for Keane took the. You know, took the opportunity to...
Yeah, because I really feel like Keane was happy enough to be like, you know, Arsenal were pretty good today, you know, it didn't work out for them. But then there was like...
Arsenal said that.
Yeah, yeah. Then the second Arsenal said that, he was like, actually, hold on a minute. You're talking shite.
Yeah. But so he was complaining, Arteta was complaining a little bit about, this was one of the many, many millions of VAR incidents over the weekend, and people have been like saying, don't talk about this because it's so boring, I don't want to listen to this, so don't talk about it.
Yeah, literally advance warnings from our listeners. So apologies to Owen Doherty and Will Ryan in particular here, who tweeted me and you in advance again to ask, please, no.
Please don't talk about it. But like, there's not that much else to talk about this weekend. You know what I mean? It was just...
Well, I mean, it's not even so much that, okay, there were a couple of bad... Like, there were game-defining... VAR decisions
in several different matches, yeah. Like so many that I'm sitting here thinking, well, I can't. I actually, there's so many that I don't have them all in my head. You know what I mean? It's like Lee Mason had his fingerprints on a few of them. You know, people were going on about Lee, you know, full time VAR official Lee Mason, who just sits there, you know, remotely ruining matches. But the Martinelli goal was an absolutely brilliant goal by Arsenal, where Saka, a perfect pass by Saka, and then an amazing finish on the run by Martinelli, which was then ruled out for a foul by Odegaard and Eriksen, which was a foul, right? That's, I mean, in my opinion, there's nothing actually controversial about the decision. What obviously sticks in the craw, though, from Arsenal's point of view, is the fact that this foul has been just waved along for much of the season. I mean, that's been the whole we got our game back thing. You know, we got our game back. Our game is about pushing people over from behind and then, you know, running away with the ball. And we've got that back. But then when it actually happens and it leads to a goal, which for Arsenal was a huge, you know, a match-defining moment, they decide to rule it out. But also, weirdly, the referee was staring at it for so long. Like, it's a simple decision. It's like he pushed him over. He doesn't actually get the ball. Like, Eriksen goes down a little bit weakly. You know, I mean, you had like, I mean, it was a... Was it Shearer over the weekend saying, well, we need to get ex-pros involved?
Danny Murphy. It was Danny Murphy.
Do ex-pros want to get involved? Do how many ex-pros want to be referees? I don't know. Maybe they do.
Historically, none.
Or is he talking about getting involved?
I can't think of any example.
Exactly. It's like, okay, Danny, who are these people? But I mean, also, and if they do want to get involved, then is he saying they should go straight onto the VAR panel? Or is he, because you obviously have to work your way, but do you have to work your way up?
I assume
Maybe you can just ignore all that. You can be an ex-pro and go straight into the VAR box.
Just drop Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank in there.
Right in the mix. Of
Jimmy Floyd was like, oh, that's not a foul. Like, well, I mean, it is a foul. Like, he runs into him from behind. You know, Eriksen is trying to move his right leg forward and Odegaard stops him doing that. So he sort of trips over and like miscontrols the ball to Saka, I guess it was. And so it's a foul. But for some reason, the referee has to look at this for ages. I mean, he's the guy who's originally just let it go. And then he's kind of going, do I have to disallow this? Because, you know, obviously it looks like my mistake if I do. But okay, I mean, so really obviously a foul. But it's just, this is what happens when you decide, okay, randomly, we're just going to enforce some of these. And if it's an important one, you know, which leads to go, yeah, we'll... So it's a totally ridiculous situation. But obviously there was a lot of the game to go. From that point, it was still 0-0. You know, Arsenal had the better, continued to have the better game, just couldn't score, you know, couldn't kind of put away these chances that they were making. Then when Manchester United made a chance, Anthony just swishes it into the net. Again, I mean, how much better is Bruno Fernandes, by the way, without Cristiano Ronaldo and the team? I mean, his pass for the second goal was absolutely brilliant. This was the one that Eriksen was joking about, should he have used his left foot. Yeah. But the way that he kind of read the direction of Arsenal's movement, the movement of the Arsenal back line, and played the ball against that movement to catch them, you know, basically it was the pass just went, beat them, and Rashford just kind of catapulted through and was able to score, even though his control wasn't that good. Like, he kind of... He didn't go onto it as smoothly as really he would have liked. Was just an amazing... Now, it helps if the player that you're playing the ball through to can actually run onto the pass, which I feel has been a problem for Bruno, you know, in the Ronaldo era at Manchester United. But he has now scored 23, or rather, I saw Opta's stat of 23 assists from open play, which is more than anyone else in the Premier League since he arrived in the Premier League, which is phenomenal when you consider the obvious player that everyone is going to think.
Yeah. I thought the Eriksen-Bruno thing looked like it could work long term as well, the two of them playing in the same midfield, which seems like a luxury in some ways, but I suppose you've got your McTominay in there to give them a...
Well, Eriksen is just so perceptive with his use of the ball. I mean, so it was his pass really that creates the unbalanced situation for Arsenal that led to the first goal. Then obviously his run for the third goal. I think he passed it to Bruno for the second goal as well. If you remember the Liverpool game, he was the one who opened up the chance for Sancho's goal in that game. And yeah, I mean, he's it was a great signing, you know. I mean, and he's also fit, you know, physically he looks good. I mean, this is the thing about Eriksen. I mean, obviously he had this traumatic incident, which immediately then everyone sort of puts a question mark: is this guy going to be able to play at the same type of level after this crazy thing that happened? But when you look at his record throughout his career, he's always been one of the top runners on the field. You know, he's always been like an absolute long distance runner in games, and he's still able to do that.
Yeah, it's also just a matter of how long it takes to get back to the physical level that he was at, regardless of how traumatic his thing was, even if it's just any...
Just the absence.
Yeah, any serious injury that leaves you out of football for that long. You could see it in the early days at Brentford, even though he was getting there. It didn't seem like his touch was quite the same for the first few games, and maybe there's wasn't also, quite I'm getting sure. around the park as much as he does. All that kind of, and even at that, he was still making a huge impact and kept them up almost single-handedly. So it shows how good he can be when he's anywhere near back to his best, which he seems to be getting at Man United.
That's kind of... I know the point you're making about it existing independent of the reason for his absence, but then I think as well, it's only a human reaction to be very, very careful about testing the boundaries of your physical limits for a long time.
You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Whereas now, having like a body of work after the heart incident, he knows now, like he trusts his body again, I think. And I think that you can actually really see that even in the last couple of games.
Yeah. So that was that. But I mean, this was an example of a game actually where the refereeing wasn't bad ultimately. You know, it was normal, I would say. It's just the context made that first goal a little bit more controversial than it should have. The first disallowed goal, I should say, be more controversial than it should have been. And in this respect, it was maybe the best refereed match, because again, okay, we don't want to talk about the referees, but when these things happen, I mean, there's nothing else you can say. I mean, the Leicester Brighton game had some of the most ridiculous stuff. I mean, there was one, the Alexis McAllister scored a goal in this game, which was the best shot that, like, he absolutely Stephen Reed'd this ball. It was unbelievable. It was everyone was just brought that down, and then it's disallowed for like the most trivial offside, which where it's even arguable that, like, I mean, number one, they can't get a clear picture of the offside incident. They take forever to try and to guess an approximation of where people are offside, so they can't even tell for sure that it is. And then the guy who they're saying is offside doesn't actually touch the ball. They could have waved that one through pretty easily, I feel. I mean, there was, you know, there have been other, I think of the own goal that Bournemouth scored against Liverpool the other week. And that was one where Mepham, the defender, clearly is only doing this because of the offside Luis Diaz. But Diaz, again, he doesn't touch the ball. I guess the difference is he's the other side of the defender rather than sort of, you know, interfering with the defender's, you know, trying to get the ball before it gets there. And that, it just seems such a trifling difference. Mm-hmm. One of them is offside and one of them isn't. Anyway, so very importantly, that magnificent goal of the season goal was ruled out.
McAllister had to make do then with a 25-yard screamer of a free kick.
Which was a totally different type of strike, but equally magnificent. You know, I mean, he scored a brilliant one last season as well, I think, McAllister. He really is able to hit them. But there was ridiculous decisions in this game. I mean, there was a Madison chopped down one of the Brighton guys. I mean, it was 4-2, so it didn't really affect it. It was already 4-2. It's a blatant penalty and not given. I have no idea how or why. But yeah, Leicester are in pretty deep trouble.
We got an email in about that, actually, from our friend Lucy Barnes. Who, do you remember Lucy getting in touch after the season preview? She was disgusted with yourself and John Bruin speculating about Leicester possibly being in the relegation fight, but she said, I offered this up as a hostage to fortune, and it appears that fortune has enthusiastically accepted my hostage and is inflicting horrible punishments on it. Now, there's a lot of, I'm going to say Lucy's not a big fan of Brendan Rodgers' work at the moment.
Well, she's a Leicester fan.
Mm. Yeah, I know, but I mean, isn't this the man who brought them to FA Cup glory, almost into the Champions League on two different occasions?
Almost.
He's done a lot for the club, almost. Fifth is pretty good for Leicester, is what I'm saying. But anyway, that seems to be forgotten. Lucy says, Unfortunately, Brendan seems to agree with Ken and John, repeatedly suggesting that his players aren't good enough, and the lack of new arrivals this summer has led to fan frustration. Rather than this frustration being caused by watching previously capable and confident players unable to hang on to a lead, unable to avoid defeat against 10 men, and unable to score a goal against struggling League Two opposition, perhaps we should have followed last summer's blueprint when we brought in four new players who Rodgers has usually tended to stick on the bench or leave out of the squad. I can only hope that our deadline day purchase of curly-haired David Luiz impressionist Wout Faes is enough to appease the angry transfer gods and get us out of trouble. Although it hasn't impressed Rodgers, who has said that his motley crew of clown-footed FA Cup winners and European semi-finalists are targeting the 40-point mark this season. It seems increasingly possible that the club will seek the change that Rodgers has been asking for by shipping him out for a new manager, surely the greatest sacrifice of all.
Yeah, I mean, it did sound as though Rodgers was... I mean, we were talking about it last week, that he had used the magic words specifically designed to eject himself from the job of, well, we haven't had the support. But, they obviously didn't take the bait. And then they get another terrible result. I mean, the four players that Lucy refers to last season they brought in were Daka, who actually scored in the game in the weekend, Samari, who played, Vestergaard, who hasn't played much, and Ryan Bertrand. So they were the guys they signed last year. I actually think the transfer window that wasn't as bad for Leicester as I was thinking it was going to be, because at the time when we were talking about that, it looked as though Maddison was going to go to Newcastle. Tielemans was, they were talking about him moving as well. And Vardy even, I think, had been linked to the move. Maddison and Tielemans, whatever about Vardy at this point, are huge players for Leicester, and they're both still there. So...
They did lose Fofana and Schmeichel, though.
They lost Fofana. It's not great, but they've got someone in to replace. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think that it's not as it didn't turn out as badly as I was thinking. If you've still got those players, there's no way that they should be. I mean, I was thinking if they lose them and don't get anyone, then I don't know what they're going to do. But they've still got them, so I assume
with a new manager, they can still easily finish 7th or 8th.
Well, they can finish 10th. I find it hard to imagine finishing 7th. They've lost 5 games already. Mm. 5 out of 6.
You can lose a lot of games and finish 8th in the Premier League. A lot of games.
Yeah. No, you can't. They would need to,
I'm sure,
turn it around.
Hopeful is thankful, Murph, for your interjection, but I do feel that is a relegation battle for Leicester.
One thing does have to happen first, though.
Yeah. Brendan's
done all he can to get out of there. So now Leicester have to step up and do the job that he couldn't.
They're also due to announce apparently the biggest loss in the Premier League for last season, like nearly £120 million loss. So that explains, I guess, their attitude, their attitude to reinforcements. So, let's make do with what, let's focus on coaching and training the team. So that is...
So come on. When are we going to get to Chelsea and West Ham?
Well, I mean,
poor
Moyes. Again, it's just.
I mean, I'm sorry, everyone. Moyes. I'm sorry. We don't want to be here talking about VAR either. But the fact of the matter is, Moyes got screwed with his trousers on.
Well, I mean, he's described it as scandalous and rotten. which I mean, it was ridiculous. Again, and it's just, you have to say fair play to Mendy, who did what he could in the situation. he pretended to be injured, clearly he wasn't. And
are you just heartbroken that your mistake, Mendy?
This is one of the many problems at the moment, because we've made the mistake, I think, of saying this ourselves on this podcast, and you hear it all the time. Oh, there's no point diving, or there's no point there's no point doing X, Y, and Z because VAR is going to catch it anyway. Yeah. But actually, doesn't catch stuff. VAR gets stuff wrong all the time.
Yeah.
So you may as well try your luck, and you may as well go down like you've got a broken arm and hope for the best. Because if the ref doesn't give it to you, the VAR official possibly will.
There's still a chance. I mean, so people say, "Oh, it's not VAR; it's the people using it." No, it's not. Whoever you put using this is going to make mistakes.
You mean Howard Webb's not going to be the savior? This is the big thing. Mike Riley's stepping down. Howard Webb is stepping up.
I don't see Howard Webb as being a magical, having
announced Webb.
They've announced Webb, Murph.
Yeah, but we still want to see Webb.
Yeah.
Get him in there. What are we waiting for? This is the best league in the world, Owen. Get Howard Webb in there.
That was, it was huge. And this is a massive result for West Ham against, obviously, in a derby match. And instead they end up losing a game that they had been winning. Declan Rice was giving, I prefer not to speak, all that. If before I speak, speaking. I'm in big trouble.
Before speaking and then tweeting.
But I do have sympathy with his... point of view. Like, it's just... Like, I mean, again, but it's just a subjective decision. Do you think this is a foul? It's not a foul. I mean, his the boot of Jared Bowen sort of scuffs over Mendy as he jumps over him. Pff, not a foul. And, I mean, this... it's probably I've read too many of those messages saying don't talk about this. It's
you've, like, got, you've been rattled. Owen Doherty and Will Ryan have rattled you here, Ken. You haven't even mentioned Coach Marsh yet. Who's even more irate than
Coach Marsh, the bad boy coach.
I'm telling you, he is.
I told you about
it. He's a wrong.
The moment I saw him, he's trouble.
That lad.
When who was sent off? The Chelsea player who was sent off against Leeds, and he has his fist in the air, eyes closed, applauding, just absolutely. I'm like, this guy's a dick. he's really good. And Murph, Premier League is.
I've never heard you use such unparliamentary language.
The Premier League is full of. Big characters, to use the euphemism. And Jesse Marsh is another one of those. On the
he's the biggest
the
character you've ever seen, that's for sure.
Yeah, now so he gets sent off for... I mean, he was whining and bitching for a lot of the game. You know, Leeds gave away a penalty for a foul on Ivan Toney, which I thought was a penalty. Mm. Fair enough. But then they should have had one. Somerville goes into the box and it's blatant. And I don't know if they decided it was outside or...
I actually have forgotten that one. I am at the stage now where I've started...
There was just so many of them. Like, there was just so much nonsense. And that's why he got sent off. And again, I have a bit of sympathy for him, but like he obviously was sort of cruising for this, you know, this was written into his, script. And we know what happens when you get a red card. You can't play the next match. So he will miss... I guess Leeds' next game. I don't know if they're going to appeal. He accused the referees of a lack of respect. But, of course, you only get what you give.
That's
the
what
respect
you get for
game.
When you get ejected from the game.
Yeah.
You're going to have to suffer the punishment.
So he was ejected from the game. So, yeah, like, I mean, again, it was just a total mess. Apparently, they're going to review this. There are going to be... Oh, there's two specific ones. We haven't even mentioned the one of them that are going to... So the two they're going to review are the West Ham equaliser, which was disallowed, and then the own goal by Palace against Newcastle, I mean, Tyrick Mitchell was the Palace defender who got his head on this ball into the box. So it was a masterclass of defending by him. First of all, he pushes Joe Willock out of the way, and then he heads the ball into his own net. Willock collides with the goalkeeper. And the foul is disallowed, or the goal is disallowed, because Willock has supposedly fouled the goalkeeper without any account taken of the fact that he's been pushed into the goalkeeper by the guy who's just scored an own goal. So, I mean, just insane. Like, I mean, the kind of thing you could imagine a referee getting wrong in real time. And then when you've actually had a chance to look at it, you're like, oh no, I see what happened here.
Alan Shearer wanted a little bit more Jesse Marsh in Eddie Howe's response to this. Felt meek Eddie Howe was being a little bit too nice about the whole thing.
Yeah, he's just standing there a little tense, smile. And, you know...
It's not ideal.
His sort of cold passive aggression doesn't quite grab the attention of the officials in the manner that
Jesse,
he would have liked
waving
to
your arms around and shouting like a lunatic is better.
I mean, Eddie Howe seems to have a pretty good disciplinary record in terms of his own standings off. I can't remember him getting sent off too many times. Maybe I've forgotten. But yeah, I mean, again, but it just goes to show, like, the and you see it often with these decisions, the sort of tunnel vision people have when they look at the the classic example is the Van Dijk injury against Jordan Pickford. Obviously came up against each other in a game which we haven't even mentioned yet, but where they reviewed this thing on VAR, and what you have is a massive foul by the goalkeeper of Van Dijk, which puts him out of the game for a year. And all they are focused on is this offside? You know, they're just checking to see, is this thing offside? And once they've established, yeah, this is actually fractionally offside, that's the decision. There's nothing about what happens after the offside.
He rolls around in agony into an offside position, but it's fine. Yeah.
But in this Palace one, it was like, all they're looking at is the way that Willock collides with the goalkeeper. And they're just looking at the, well, he seems to have kind of gone into him a bit there. And literally just don't, like, it's blind to the to how that actually happened. They're just not looking at that. And so you, so that's some, I think that explains sometimes a lot of these decisions. Then again, they take forever to, you know, they obviously did that one quickly enough. I don't know. Maybe they could.
And I mean, I know the instance that you're talking about. I have seen it where they're just, they do have a tunnel vision, but I can't believe that that's happened in that scenario, in the Mitchell Willick one.
Yeah.
Because Willick charges into him, but his body is not like, his body doesn't have the momentum of someone just charging into somebody.
Yeah.
It has the momentum of, I'm running in towards goal, and then I've just gotten a massive shove in midair, which means that his hip is out in front of his chin nearly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's such a terrible, terrible decision.
Yeah, it was a lot of nonsense. Oh, it really was just nonsense.
Okay.
It's not going to get any better. It's just getting worse.
But you've been banging that drum for a long number of years.
Me and Antonio Conte.
Yeah, it gives you no pleasure to be this right. This startlingly 110% right on this issue, but it gives you no play.
And obviously, on Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard, much maligned lions of the dugout, both getting good results over the weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, credit where credit is due. Kyle Walker became the latest Man City player to do the thing where you ignore Erling Haaland.
Jesus.
Did you see his?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Was comedy.
I imagine how much fun would it be to just have Haaland go over there and just throttle Kyle Walker just for like 10 seconds. You know, it's like he's not going to pass out or anything, but just Haaland just like grab him by the neck and just lift him off the ground 6 inches and just throttle him for 10 seconds, pop him back on the ground and let Walker run back to his position.
And of course,
do you think Kyle Walker would do something different the next time he's in position if Haaland had throttled him for 10 seconds in Villa
Park? I think he'll be spoken to about it. He might have to sit down for a video session.
Speaking's one thing, but a throttling is a whole other level. Yeah.
And obviously that game also had another terrible decision when a late Villa winner is ruled out. It's not really a winner. It's not a ruled out goal because the whistle is blown before the shot by Coutinho. And then you can argue over, well, the City players have stopped playing.
Well, I definitely
here.
Would argue about that. That everyone's talking about it being a disallowed. Like, everyone did stop playing and then he just strolled along. And
it's nice though, isn't it, to just have that, for a linesman to randomly decide, I'm actually going to be an old-fashioned linesman here.
Yeah.
I feel this game could do with a bit of old-fashioned linesmanship, so I'm going to ignore the whole thing of,
yeah, I'm not
we're going to let
referee
this play.
Now. I'm back to being a linesman as well.
Yeah, I'm a lino.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to say, that's offside. I'm confidently going to issue a wrong decision and cancel this attack before he has a chance to shoot, which is what happened. So it was a nice moment from Manchester City's point of view, but again, a somewhat bewildering one. When you consider all of the ways that they're supposed to be behaving, to see them do that, you're like, well, this isn't it.
Okay, Mike Riley, Howard Webb, it was a pleasure sharing this report on sport with you two guys.
What I thought was a seat was in fact a bunk, top bunk, coffin-shaped. I was like, I do hope they turn the air conditioning on in this train, and I'm sweating quite profusely. There was a sort of an old Russian woman in the bunk underneath mine, kind of grabbing at me, like, to get out of the bed. No, yet. She went to sort of the little service area of the carriage and came back with, like, a little packet of sheets. Fresh and clean.
Yeah.
And, oh... so good next to the skin, Owen. So good next to the skin, Owen. I said, oh, spasibo. Babushka tried to take the sheets. She's like, no, haven't none of it. Started putting the sheets on the bed for me. I was like, trying to help. She's like, yeah. I was just lying on that sort of sticky, musty mattress thing. But it turns out that they give you like a whole pack of sheets that you can spread out. Fresh and clean.
Yeah.
And, oh. So good next to the skin, Owen. Slept almost all the way to Moscow. So good next to the skin, Owen. What a nice way to pass 6 hours in train that was.
Mark Critchley was at a boisterous Old Trafford yesterday for the Independent to watch the victory over Arsenal. Mark, good to talk to you as always.
Good to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
I was about to call it a morale-boosting victory, but morale had already been boosted, I guess, over the last couple of weeks. It's just increased that further, and I guess this one felt a little bit you know, a little bit like of a rubber stamping of what's been going on since the disastrous first couple of games of the season.
You're always a bit reluctant with this Manchester United team to ever say that they turned a corner. I wrote that in the report yesterday, just because, and even now it feels ridiculous to even be raising that subject or using those words to describe what's happening at the minute, because there's obviously such a long way to go. But at the same time, I feel that you know, the kind of response that they've had since that Brentford game, it wasn't inevitable. There was things that they had to put right in order to react in this way. And just with every game that's gone along, you felt a little bit more confident that, that again, not turning the corner as such, but that at least the foundations and the brickwork that has been laid in place by Erik ten Hag to really build something going forward. You picked up on the atmosphere yesterday. I thought it was brilliant from the first minute. A real kind of throwback. And we always talk about the history of this fixture, but yesterday you could sense that inside the stadium as well. And I feel that just, you know, from that Liverpool game, things have really just picked up and taken off, really. And I think that's largely down to the spirit, really, that I think that the new manager is trying to set in place. And you can see the evidence of that out on the pitch.
I remember your Is This Sustainable piece last year, where this was sort of the late Solskjaer period when United were kind of consistently getting results despite being outplayed. And, you know, there's an element of that, you know, in the sense of if you take a crude measure like possession or whatever, Arsenal did have most of the ball in this game. But, you know, United won the game 3-1, you know, and a similar kind of pattern to their victory over Liverpool. So does this feel different? I mean, you know, and superficially similar maybe to what they've been doing before, but you feel it's better somehow?
I feel that you're absolutely right. I don't know if it's superficially similar. I think it just genuinely is quite similar at the moment. Looking at the way that they attack on those three goals yesterday, wrote a piece last night about just how you compare that and the Liverpool game to some of this is the kind of game plan that Solskjaer used, and the difference really, I think, is that, well, there's a few things that are different. I mean, with all due respect, I think Erik ten Hag's coming with a greater pedigree than Solskjaer did, so he's got a bit more leeway. He's got a bit more leverage in the job from people at the start. But also, when he talks about the way that they're playing at the minute, he's talking about a process, and you know maybe it's a buzzword that managers use. I think it's been used for Mikel Arteta as well in the past. But you kind of quite genuinely and sincerely get the sense that he, at the moment, the way that United are playing, this isn't his final vision of, this isn't how he pictured his United to play. I think the way that the season started, those defeats, really kind of made clear that there's severe limitations to this squad still. It's still a hugely imbalanced squad. It was bloated. It's been cut down a little bit now. There's a lot of things that still, a lot of areas that still needs to be worked on. And so, you know, I think there's this perception of Ten Hag because of the Ajax association, because of him working under Guardiola and observing Guardiola for a few years. There's this kind of idea that he's a guy who's an ideologue like Guardiola. He wants his teams to possess the ball. He wants to press. He wants, you know, this kind of progressive, expansive style of play. And while I think that United are probably working towards that and will be going towards that in the longer term, I think what he's shown over the past few weeks is a side to his management style that is purely kind of pragmatism. And he's looked at the squad that he's got at his disposal. He's figured out ways, especially in these two games against Liverpool and Arsenal, of beating teams who will offer space in behind. And he's used that. And yeah, like you say, you know, possession is a really crude kind of way of looking at it. But just looking at it last night, obviously they've had less of the ball in these two games against Liverpool and Arsenal. Possession was around even in the Southampton and Leicester games as well, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. It was actually only in the two defeats, where they actually really dominated the ball. So I think he has, over the last few weeks, looked at the way the team's playing and said, we actually need to do things maybe a little bit different than I would have liked straight away in order to salvage a few results and just generate that good feeling that you've seen around the club.
Although there are glimpses of something more sophisticated. I mean, you talked in your piece about, I mean, there's a bit of crumbs to a starving man here, but apparently there was an 8-pass move against Leicester, which has already passed into legend.
8 passes. Tell us
about this eight pass move and why it got everybody so excited.
Well, I think it's like you can probably find the video. It was it was widely shared around, and I think it was highlighted in the commentary on BT as well. It's like an 8-pass move really doesn't sound that impressive whatsoever. And if you watch it, it's nothing that you wouldn't see most of the top teams do most weeks. But I think from a United side, it's basically, it was against Leicester and it's very deep in their own half under a lot of possession, under a lot of pressure from Leicester's press. And just the way that they managed to manipulate the ball out of that situation, building up kind of patiently and methodically, while also in quite an aesthetically pleasing kind of way. Again, like those are simple kind of principles that you haven't really seen the United team execute over the past couple of years, or even really try to execute. You know, I think, and that's what I talk about when I'm saying about, I feel like even though these signature wins have come without the ball and on the counter attack and in a style and in a manner that was very familiar from Solskjaer's days, whereas with Solskjaer, it sometimes felt like the result was an end within itself. And if they won one of these big games, he'd come in afterwards and he'd say, this result can be the turning point for us. And it was almost like 3 points were what mattered. It does feel like within, you know, there's these little, like you say, crumbs within United's performance that suggest that Ten Hag is working towards something bigger and something that you haven't really seen before. But again, it's early days. And I think it all sounds very positive at the minute. Just the way that this club has been run over the past few years, just the way that the squad is, there's going to be setbacks, further setbacks along the way. But for now, you can just see that the building blocks are being put in place.
One thing that Ten Hag has that Solskjaer didn't have is Christian Eriksen in his midfield. And, you know, there were signs yesterday that we all know how good a player Eriksen is, and if they find the right sort of role for him tactically within that team, he can do a lot of damage. I was very impressed with him yesterday. Have you seen roughly what you think Ten Hag wants to get out of Eriksen within that midfield?
I think so. I think, people might have expected him to come and play a bit more of an advanced role, but this is kind of what he was doing at Brentford last season. I think Ten Hag recognised that. It might be the fact that that's how he needs to play now, since obviously the incident at the Euros. But I feel like, you know, if you look at how regularly he's played, really, Ten Hag's trusted him, kept him on. I think he's played all but 10 minutes of these first 6 games of the season, which speaks to his level of fitness, even if there were concerns around that initially. I think he has looked a little tired in some games, particularly the Liverpool game. And it's been interesting that Ten Hag kept it on that long. And there's maybe, I guess, with the disallowed goal yesterday and obviously the incident at Brentford, you just wonder whether in that role, in a deeper role in midfield, whether he's just pressed a little bit too easily and whether players can get to him a little bit too quickly. But other than that, I mean, what he's doing, his vision, his composure, and those kind of attributes and characteristics that he's showing in that midfield are really, again, something that you don't necessarily associate with United teams over the past few years.
Yeah, I like where he's playing, I have to say. Now, one of the other drawbacks is that he has to do more defending in that position, and he outlined it quite well yesterday when he was doing the post-match interview on Sky, that he had to chase Odegaard around the place quite a lot, which, you know, doesn't sound like what we would associate with Christian Eriksen. But I actually think when he has the ball, he always gives himself time to look up anyway. He's playing it from deeper positions. You've got Bruno further forward who can do the kind of intricate final pass anyway, so it seems like quite a good combination. Certainly yesterday it worked well. They combined brilliantly. I think they were probably involved in all 3 goals.
Yeah, and I think you're right. The balance there with Bruno slightly more advanced, and then McTominay's been playing there. And I think, you know, people might be scratching their heads as to why Casemiro's not come in yet. But McTominay, for all, I think, you know, in some aspects of his performance yesterday, was sometimes a little bit all over the place, but he was being that kind of physical presence that is, you know, I'm not saying Eriksen always needs his protection, but he is offering it there as well. And I expect Casemiro will come in and do that further down the line. But at the moment, you know, I asked Ten Hag the other week just about after they brought in Casemiro, whether he wanted to add anything more to that midfield there, because it's been such a priority for him, and one that in his answer, he kind of hinted that down the line, yes, he would maybe like better options in there, more options in there. But he said he basically feels that the balance that he's got at the moment is, you know, is much better than when he first came into the club, when it definitely needed addressing. So, yeah, and I think you can see that, and they're all complementing each other really well.
How impressed were you with Antony? I mean, it's always difficult for a player in that position to get a lot of time on the ball, get a lot of moments on the ball when the other team has it most of the time, but he did use it pretty well when the ball came to him, and it seems as though he seems to feel as though Old Trafford is, you know, 76,000 stadium is kind of his natural environment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the one kind of common thread that you've got between a lot of the signings that have come in this summer has been a sort of aggression. And Ten Hag's talked about the fight, the kind of fighting spirit. He keeps using that phrase quite a lot. And with Antony, I mean, maybe not so much clear in the performance, but in the celebration itself, just to take that long to purposely go over to celebrate in front of the Arsenal fans and to really try and endear himself to the crowd. You can see that he's got that as well, a kind of swagger and arrogance. I mean, I think it was only like a couple of minutes after he scored that goal that he was trying to lob Ramsdale from about 30 yards out. And you can...
I think it was a bit further than that, actually.
I think it was... You're probably right, yeah. He's got that swagger, and you can sometimes... You can question his decision-making a little bit, I thought. He also seems like very, very one-footed, coming in off that right wing onto his left. I mean, the finish itself felt quite telegraphed and maybe stoppable from Ramsdale's perspective. But that's the kind of profile that's very rare in European football these days. The left-footed right winger is something United have missed, really. They had Greenwood, who kind of filled that role, but, you know... Yeah. They've never really had an out-and-out winger in that sense. And I thought, yeah, yesterday he tailed off a little bit after the goal and obviously got substituted around the hour mark. So it wasn't, you know, a full display of his abilities. But no, generally, like, again, just little questions over his decision-making and one-footedness. But I thought it was you can't really complain with the goal in your debut and managing, like I said, to endear yourself to the crowd in the way you did with the celebration.
A word then on the... Still league leaders, Arsenal, who had such a great start to the season. Mikel Arteta seemed pretty frustrated afterwards, kind of, how did we lose? That seemed to be his general vibe. How did they lose? I mean, you know, Arsenal, I thought, played some lovely football. Obviously, they kind of dominated in some ways of the game. So why did they end with such a disappointing result? Where do they fall down?
Arteta put it down to moments of indiscipline, and I think if the two goals that really, you know, that win the game, the two Rashford goals, are a matter of the line probably being a little bit too high and perhaps pressing a little bit too high.
Gabriel throwing himself to the ground didn't help.
It'd be that as well. So, you know, those moments I think he identified as the reasons for the defeat, and I kind of agreed with his analysis largely, in that if you're an Arsenal supporter, you come away from that game obviously disappointed, but I feel like there was enough to take away to feel that you will be able to compete in the top four. But that possibly still just tempers the expectations that have built up over the past few weeks, and it's probably no bad thing. You know, I think this time of the season especially, you do have to always account for the schedule, because really it's six games, and people, you know, it has such a huge impact.
Do you think... Do you think they're going to finish ahead of Man United? I mean, I saw Roy Keane after the game was just super confident. United asserts for the top four was his view, which is, you know, not a lot of people were saying 2 weeks. I don't think even he was saying 2 weeks ago. But, you know, who do you think is better of these two teams? Who's better set now?
I'd probably back Arsenal to finish in the top four before United. At the moment, I don't think yesterday particularly changes that much in that regard. You know, the the fact that Ten Hag was mentioned repeatedly yesterday, the fact that they've been together with Arteta for much longer, the fact that his principles of play and his ideas are in place and settled, and I think you've been able to see that over their start. They look like a more of a stable team, I would say. And for everything that I said before about how Ten Hag at the moment is trying to show this pragmatic side and is really kind of trying to cope with what he's got at his disposal and try and make something out of that, I just feel that Arsenal probably have more in the tank going down all the way to May to get over the line. But, you know, there's probably one place up for grabs there with Chelsea's problems. Tottenham look like
Liverpool's problems.
Just about the third place thing. Well, yeah, but I feel like Liverpool's performances generally have been, would still suggest that they're of the calibre to be able to get top four. I don't know if you disagree with that, but it's felt like for a long time that there's maybe only one, possibly two places up for grabs in that top four still. And I would just about edge Arsenal still, because simply because they've gone closer before, they're further along down the line, and they're more settled under their manager at the moment than United are.
Mark, lovely stuff. Thanks, Emil.
Cheers, boys. Thanks.
I lost.
Yeah.
Fuck's sake, I'm not losing.
They shouldn't interview you now.
Wait, I'm not losing. I'm fucked up.
I'm not playing shit.
You get me in 10 minutes, I'll be all right. They shouldn't interview you now.
So I better go to go now. Or first I have some coaching questions.
It's too late now. What's that? Are you interviewing me or not? Seriously. Come on.
Is there an explanation for this? Is there an explanation for this?
You could be my mama and I'll be your boy.
Original road boy, never my coy.
We know you as a very good dart player.
I'm not playing shit.
Fuck's sake, I don't want to lose him.
But is there an explanation for that, or?
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not.
How do you prepare for the last match then?
These are the questions that you should be asking when we're live.
No, we're live now.
We're not live now.
Yeah, we're live. There you are on television. I'm serious. Yeah.
Why wasn't I told?
Sorry?
Should have been told.
Oh, I thought you know.
Well, do I prepare? I'll prepare the same. If I win, I win. I cannot keep playing like this. This is no good.
Would you care to answer your own final question there, Ken? Manchester United or Arsenal?
Well, I agree, actually, with Mark, for the same reasons, essentially, that Arteta's been at this for a while. And I think he's getting to where they want to be. I mean, you know, Arsenal are turning into a team that can win games that they dominate. You know what I mean? That's what they're trying to do in all their matches. So yeah, I mean, I think they're probably. I mean, we have to see what happens with United, but definitely like these results. I mean, to win four in a row, they're the only team that's done that apart from Arsenal in the league. The City haven't been able to do that, and they've beaten big teams. You know, so certainly things have radically improved from just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, and I think maybe the answer was sort of staring us in the face a little bit. I mean, when Harry Maguire came on in the game, what was the first thing that happened? He's immediately backpedaling. Yeah. Was it Jesus? And he, you know, he's got him on the run, and Maguire is backing.
Yeah, Harry Maguire immediately went to, I mean, it was a big mistake by Casemiro, wasn't it? It was Casemiro who just like got robbed of possession, and Jesus was running straight at Harry Maguire. But it was hilarious to just look at Harry Maguire. It's like, okay, I'm Harry Maguire, so one of two things is going to happen here. One of three things is going to happen here. One, I'm going to be made look like a complete fool by Gabriel Jesus. Two, I'm going to have to pick up a yellow card, perhaps even a red card for fouling him. Or three, I let him pass me and he scores a goal into the top corner because I'm Harry Maguire.
And that's what happens.
Yeah, but Lisandro Martinez's first role in the game. Martinez's first role in the game was to get out-muscled by Jesus, chase after him.
Kicked him to the ground. Tried to clear Jesus.
Jesus did embarrass both starting Manchester United centre-halves at various points as well. Mm.
Yeah.
But it was just the Maguire-ness of it all. It was just like,
that thing when you've got a huge man.
Yeah.
A huge man sort of on the run, three-quarters run, trying to look behind him as he sort of, you know, and it's all going towards the D. And you just, it just creates fear and commotion. And that's been missing from this run because he just... He dropped him, you know. And you saw Ronaldo come on. Ronaldo actually nearly set up a goal for Arsenal as well with a shoulder pass. Did you see that? He played a ball with his shoulder. You're like, wow, that's amazing. Oh, it's gone straight to them. But so I think that really has, you know, you don't overlook that big. I mean, it was a big decision politically for Ten Hag to take. But like he said, look, I suppose this is my team. I'm not going to go down necessarily with Harry Maguire and Cristiano Ronaldo. Let's do it my way. If I'm going to go down, let's go down my way.
It doesn't get much more glamorous than Real Madrid coming to town, and that's what's happening in Glasgow tomorrow night in the Champions League. Celtic have set themselves up nicely for this one with a 4-0 win against Rangers in the Old Firm. Kieran Canning, how are you?
Very well, thank you guys for having me on.
Barry Ferguson told readers of the Daily Record that Gio van Bronckhorst had got Ange Postecoglou sussed, which didn't seem to be, the evidence didn't seem to be there to back up Barry Ferguson's bold assertions on Saturday.
Well, I think there is something in the fact that Gio van Bronckhorst might have had Ange sussed, but his players didn't, because van Bronckhorst said afterwards, and even judging by his reaction on the sidelines, that he'd told Rangers what to expect on Saturday. And that was when Celtic, when the game is stopped, you know, they have this, one of Vange's sayings from early on in his time, and it's kind of been used as a slogan to sell season tickets and things, is we never stop, you know, so throw-ins, free kicks, the ball is back in play very quickly. And Rangers just didn't react to at least two of the goals, arguably three. One of which you could see van Bronckhorst quite clearly pointing to, like, the unmarked Celtic player, whilst three of his own players just sort of dawdled around and were ball watching. So in that aspect, then, you know, Barry Ferguson might have got it right, but I think that was the only bit he got right, which is, you know, in keeping with form for Barry.
Well, there seems to be this, and I'm sure Ferguson isn't the only person who's made these kinds of points there, because it was put to the manager afterwards and he said, listen, this whole plan A thing, we used to hear this with Pep at Barcelona back in the day, anytime they had a rare negative result, it's like, well, what's his other plan besides this amazing plan that has them winning European Cups and La Liga titles the entire time? And it seems to be the same here. It's like, there's only one plan. It's just that type of football you talk about, high octane, all that kind of stuff. But I suppose if plan A is young, energetic players who never stop playing fast attacking football, then maybe that's all right.
Yeah, and I think Postecoglou actually explained this pretty well himself towards the end of last week when they were summing up the transfer window. And if you think of plan A only being, yes, it's, you know, 4-3-3, inverted wingers, very high tempo, yes, there is only one, there's only plan A. But this game kind of showed the fact that what he's tried to build and what explained he tried to build is, even within that system, there's different players that do very different things. And you saw, I mean, Celtic, in theory, should have had a huge blow within the first minute, because Kyogo Furuhashi, who's the sort of star striker, has been in excellent form to the start of the season, went off with a shoulder injury in the first minute. And he's a very small, diminutive, quick, all about movement off the ball kind of striker. They bring in Giakoumakis, who's like much more your sort of traditional big number nine, penalty box, holds the ball up, maybe doesn't, you know, run in behind as much. So that's, you know, two strikers of very different styles, but they both fit perfectly into the system. And it, you know, Celtic didn't miss a beat despite the fact that Kyogo, you know, barely featured in the game at all.
It's a hell of a rebuilding job, this, really, isn't it? Because it's only, like, it's hardly 18 months since Celtic were being pilloried for going on like a booze coronavirus tour of Dubai. And they were all lying around on sun loungers, and everybody was, I mean, it seemed to generally, to really enrage much of the Scottish nation. And at that point, they looked like they were, the team had totally disintegrated. And this team now seems better than ever.
Well, I think you've missed out one key point there, Ken, which is, you know, the Shane Duffy factor. I mean, look what's happened to Brighton since he left there as well. You know, it's maybe it's something that Ireland
is harsh on our guest in London last year.
I'm only joking with that. But I think that the big thing was, in terms of the rebuilding job around this time last year. So this summer, it's sort of building upon the foundations of what they did the last summer transfer window, which started terribly. You know, there was a few instances where players were given contracts just after Ange came in, just because they needed bodies, basically. They'd lost a lot of players. they started the season with guys they knew were going to leave and did leave, like on the last day of the transfer windows, like Edouard went to Crystal Palace, Christie went to Bournemouth. But in the meantime, managed to get in. And what's been quite remarkable is the recruitment they brought in from all different parts of the world. So you've got the Japanese guys, which Postecoglou obviously knew very well from his time in Japan, but you're picking up sort of gems for relatively little money from the English leagues. Jota scored a great goal at the weekend from sort of Benfica Academy. Abada, who also scored at the weekend from Israel. You know, so there's this sort of vast scouting network and always working under the budget of a team in the Scottish Premiership. And for Celtic standards, they spent quite a lot of money this summer and spending £20 million. But if you compare that to, you know, what's happening in England, it's nothing. And yet to pretty much not have a failure over the past 18 months is great work in the transfer market. But I think it also shows just what a good job Postecoglou is doing, because you could buy the same players and under a different manager, they wouldn't work nearly as well. And what he's done, it's kind of shows all the hallmarks of good management. So he's a very good communicator, particularly when it comes to getting a message out there with the support. And because of that, the support got on side very early on, even through the bumps of the start of last season when the results weren't quite as good and the football wasn't as good. He's improved a lot of the players that were there already. Guys, like I thought probably the best example in the past few weeks is left-back Greg Taylor, who was kind of signed from Kilmarnock when they sold Tierney, and it was kind of a feeling that this guy, you know, he's not nearly at Tierney's level. He's not really been really a sort of Celtic level player, but has improved markedly over the past year or so, playing in that sort of inverted fullback position that you know, Guardiola's kind of made more common. And on top of that, all these guys that he's brought in from, you know, all over the world, knitted them together very well with a very good sort of team spirit, and has them playing this really exciting, really attacking brand of football. And that's what's going to be really interesting going now into the Champions League, because so far this season, they've been destroying almost everyone. Obviously, they had the 9-0 last weekend as well. It felt like Rangers was going to be the first real test of that. You know, this is a team in Rangers that got to a Europa League final last year, have knocked PSV out of the Champions League qualifiers, and they weren't able to match it. So now it goes up a level again against Real Madrid, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes, because even when Scottish teams have done relatively well, given the budgetary restraints in the Champions League, it's always tended to be a sort of counter-punching style. You think the night that Celtic beat Barcelona when Lennon was manager and they had something like 12% possession, or even Rangers in recent years when they've done very well, it's been counter-attacking sort of style of football. Celtic won't do that even against Real Madrid, and it could go terribly wrong. You know, we could be here on Wednesday morning saying, you know, it's all very well Postecoglou having his principles, but when you've got seven men chasing head of the ball against Real Madrid and Vinicius is running in behind, you know, it's suicide at that level. But that's the way they're going to play, and it's just going to be fascinating to see how it goes against that higher quality of opposition.
Yeah, I mean, because this was always I said they're better than ever, which, I mean, it was maybe a bit unfair to sort of the Rodgers team, which was pretty good, you know, unbeaten season and played some great football in Scotland, but the Champions League was always the big disappointment there. You know, I mean, they lost 7-0 to Barcelona, they lost 7-1 to PSG. I think they lost 5-0 at home to PSG. Yeah, it was just you just got used to they did have some nasty groups also, I should say, but they just got used to sort of being hammered in that competition. And you know, how confident are you that this is going to be different?
I think the really important thing for tomorrow night against Madrid is that it's to compete, even if they get beat. And there were games under Rodgers where they did that as well. They did a 3-3 with Man City in Guardiola's first season. I think they drew twice with City actually in that group. They lost 2-1 to Bayern at home, but again, it was a very close game, and you know, could have gone either way. And that's the important thing for tomorrow night, is not to get, as you say, one of those games like they had against PSG or Barca away a few years ago, like, to have that feeling that, because this is Celtic's first game in the Champions League for 5 years, so it's, you know, they've been out of the competition for quite a while, and haven't even really in that time pulled up any trees in the Europa League. So it's going to be a big step up. But I think if they do compete, and even if they lose the game, but it's close and they've shown some of the qualities that they have so far this season, there will be hope going into the rest of the group, because we've got Shakhtar and Leipzig. Now, Shakhtar obviously massively debilitated by what's happened, the situation in Ukraine. Lots of their pretty much all their Brazilians, I think, are either away to other clubs or on loan. Will be playing their home games in Poland. And Leipzig, also having a good start to the season, got beat 4-0 themselves at the weekend. So if they can compete against Madrid, it will, you know, there'll be positive signs there going forward to the rest of the games in the group, that they can, you know, really do something in the Champions League, even if that's just, you know, trying to get second place in the group behind Real Madrid.
Okay, tomorrow night, 8:00, Celtic against Real Madrid. Should be good. Thanks so much, Kieran.
Cheers, guys.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a beautiful summer's day. The breeze is stupendous.
Stupendous. Stupendous.
Would this podcast be even more stupendous without ads?
Without ads?
Ads. If so, then join us for daily commercial-free shows at secondcaptains.com for just €5 a month.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not bumping them up. I'm not Irish. I'm just saying my observations, they are amazing.
Stupendous.
I gotta say, looking at those fixtures tomorrow night, Celtic Real Madrid is the one to watch, isn't it? Celtic Real Madrid tomorrow at 8:00.
What else is on?
Well, you've got PSG, Juventus, Sevilla, Manchester City. Grand, you know, but I think there's more. It's been a while.
Yeah, no, I think Celtic Real Madrid, at least until, you know, if Madrid go 3-0 up in the first 20 minutes, I might switch over. Napoli, but I don't see that happening.
Liverpool away to Napoli on Wednesday night. Tottenham Hotspur against, welcome your old club, Marseille, to Tottenham Hotspur. That's a niche gag for very, very long time listeners there. We'll wrap
little it. Easter egg for all you 40-year-olds.
Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thanks so much for listening. A reminder to sign up to the World Service to hear all of our Champions League coverage. You'll also be hearing all episodes of the pod ad-free if you become a member on secondcaptains.com. The Second Captains podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuaders of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.